Lecture 79, Environmentalism.
After that close look at Nixon and the Watergate era, let's step back now for a broader view of environmental questions and how they also led to a new popular movement in the 1960s and 70s. Theodore Roosevelt, as president, had established a national policy towards forests, parks, and national land use. Modern environmentalism began with Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, published in 1962, a surprise bestseller that criticized the indiscriminate use of pesticides. By 1968, widespread concerns over pollution, chemicals in the atmosphere, and world overpopulation had gelled into what was at first called the ecology movement. It celebrated the first Earth Day in 1970, the year in which enabling legislation created the Environmental Protection Agency. From then on, all building projects had to be preceded by, and sometimes prevented by, environmental impact statements. Endangered species, wild rivers, and scarce water resources all became objects of government concern, as did the cleanup of toxic chemical sites. Sudden oil crises in 1973 and 79, triggered by political upheavals in the Middle East, demonstrated the need for conservation, efficiency, and economy. Environmental lobbying and demonstrations after the Three Mile Island nuclear power station accident in 1979 ended the 20-year-long growth of civilian nuclear power. By 1980, environmentalism was an established part of national life. President Reagan discovered, when he tried to scant it, that the environment and its protection were almost as popular among his own supporters, the Republicans, as among his adversaries, the Democrats. Environmentalists in the 1980s and 90s alerted the nation to further resource shortages and potential threats to the Earth's welfare. Well, to begin with the early movement in the 1960s, it developed in response to citizens' anxieties about pollution and population. Now, pollution had long been common, particularly in the air and in rivers. And I mentioned earlier that in cities like Pittsburgh, the fact that the sky was full of industrial smoke and was often yellowish-brown in hue was a source of pride because it demonstrated the fact that people were hard at work and great industrial work was being done. But by the middle and late 20th century, advances in medicine had clearly shown doctors that smoke was linked to numerous severe health problems. And more affluent citizens in particular felt that the existence of a lot of ambient air pollution was led to a deterioration in their quality of life. When Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962, criticizing the indiscriminate use of pesticides and herbicides, to her astonishment, she found that she'd struck a national chord by picking up an issue which more and more people were concerned about in one way or another. One of the chemicals about which the book was particularly sharp in its condemnation was DDT. And the history of DDT is itself a fascinating thing. When first developed in the early 1940s, it had seemed like a miraculous compound because it was an incredibly good killer of lice and mosquitoes, that is, the vectors of malaria and typhus and other diseases. So it was first widely used during the Second World War. For example, in Naples, which the Allies liberated in the middle of the Italian campaign, there was a terrible infestation of lice. But the US Army, by dusting down its soldiers and also the civilian population of Naples with DDT, was able to almost eliminate it. Similarly, Sardinia, the island of Sardinia in the Mediterranean, just after the Second World War, for centuries, malaria had been endemic there, chronic, continuous problem for nearly everybody living there. And the use of DDT to attack the malarial mosquito population ended it once and for all. Elsewhere again, particularly in Central America, it led to a sharp decline in the incidence of yellow fever. So clearly DDT was a chemical which had much to be said for it, as well as certain things against. What Carson was particularly anxious about was the fact that it didn't decompose very quickly, and so it would get into the food chain. And it would be ingested first by simple organisms, and then when larger creatures ate those, they'd concentrate the poison in their bodies, and eventually it would move up the food chain and affect people themselves. Her rhetoric was also very skillful. So she has passages where she describes the way in which a mother breastfeeding her baby, that is a relationship of consummate tenderness, could inadvertently be passing along the poison. A very good rhetorical way of getting ordinary citizens alarmed and saying to people, you're involved in this matter as well. Until then, the American chemical industry had had an extremely good reputation for being benefactors of mankind. Now the question arose and was intensified in subsequent years. They're just really one more self-interested group who are trying to sell stuff even when it's poisoning the American people. Certainly in the 50s, pesticide use sometimes was indiscriminate. It led to great fish kills in rivers, for example, when drain off from farmland concentrated toxins and killed the fish. Sometimes bird populations were killed. Sometimes even the aerial spraying of cities would lead to the deaths of domestic pets. All these things were signs that, that chemicals in the environment were a real issue. Another interesting development in the 60s was the development of consumer advocacy. And the great figure here is Ralph Nader, whose book Unsafe at Any Speed was published in 1965. What happened is that Nader followed the development and production of the Chevrolet Corvair and what he called its designed-in lack of safety. It was a hazardous car, said Nader. It could have been made much safer. But General Motors' interest in making it flashy and in selling a lot of them led them to cover up the many ways in which it ought not to have been permitted on the road in its current design. General Motors responded by hiring detectives to see whether they couldn't find some dirt on Nader himself. They had him followed to see whether he'd got an irregular sex life or so on. But it backfired on General Motors because Nader discovered what was going on, sued General Motors for harassment, won $280,000 in a settlement, and used it to set up the first consumer advocacy group, Nader's Raiders, a group who would then look into the practices of other businesses to see how scrupulously they were living up to the letter of the law, to regulations. A third important book in the development of this new frame of mind is The Population Bomb by the Stanford biologist Paul Ehrlich, published in 1968. Paul Ehrlich said, "The world's population is growing at a catastrophic rate. It's far outstripping the Earth's capacity to feed people, with the result that we're soon going to have horrifying Malthusian disasters, mass die-offs of people or genocidal wars, simply to get rid of the surplus of people." It was full of wild exaggerations, virtually all of which have been completely disproven by now. The paperback edition of the book, a bestseller in 68, had on the front an old anarchist bomb with a fizzing fuse and the title, The Population Bomb. And underneath it said, "While you are reading these words, four people have died of starvation, three of them children." So the idea to sort of work you up into a frenzy of anxiety about overpopulation. What's actually happened, incidentally, is that although the population has been growing, it tends to level off in industrial societies whose birth rates decline. And the world's production of food has more than outpaced the rise in population. It's certainly a serious issue, but not the catastrophe that Ehrlich made it sound. The Sierra Club and other environmental groups campaigned in the early 1960s to bring to an end an era of the damming of America's wild and scenic rivers. There was a plan in the early 1960s to build a big dam in the Grand Canyon in Arizona because it would back up a reservoir and make an ideal environment for the generation of hydroelectric power, just as was being done downstream at the Hoover Dam. The Bureau of Reclamation, the government agency which would have built this dam, said, "Oh, it's great to have the Grand Canyon dammed because that means that people can boat on the lake and they'll be able to see some of the geological formations of the canyon close up, which at the moment are hard to get to." Well, David Brower, who was the leader of the Sierra Club, originally a mountaineering group, which gradually became an environmental advocacy organization, said, "Oh, yes, well, by the same logic, we might as well flood the Sistine Chapel so that people can get closer to Michelangelo's murals on the ceiling." In other words, making the case that the Grand Canyon should be thought of as a place for veneration, and almost a religious place, which ought to be sacrosanct, ought not to be manipulated in this way. And much to his pleasure, the plan for the dam was abandoned, even though the Sierra Club itself lost its tax-exempt status because it had become a political lobby rather than just a club. The first Earth Day was celebrated on April the 22nd, 1970, and it did a lot to popularise the environmental cause. It was arranged by Senator Gaylord Nelson, and on the ground running events was a Harvard Law student called Dennis Hayes. And groups all over the country that day undertook symbolic acts as a way of saying, we're now going to show a new respect to the environment and to the Earth itself. Just a couple of years previously, the first spaceships had begun to fly to the moon and to take photographs of the Earth looking back from that vantage point. And then in 69, men had walked on the moon. And the picture of the beautiful Earth floating in space, it was a very, very popular poster for students of that generation, and drove home to everybody the point that this is our one and only home. We can't afford to poison it because there's nowhere else we can possibly go to. Well, on Earth Day, a group of students in San Jose buried a gas guzzler. That is a car which only went a few miles to the gallon, a massive American car, as a way of saying we're now burying this aspect of America's history. 100 students in Tacoma, Washington, rode horses to school and in doing so held up traffic on the freeway. The mayor of New York, Mayor Lindsay, closed Fifth Avenue between 14th and 59th Streets and had a street fair. Lots of communities organised litter cleaning parties, getting everybody out. And there was a wonderful mood of participation and a feel-good atmosphere as well. This is a period where most demonstrations were very bitterly divisive, and sharp disagreements and sometimes fighting among rival demonstrators was a commonplace of the era. So to have everybody coming out onto the streets to say, well, we all breathe the same air, it was a relaxing moment in the midst of a very, very tense era. And certainly politicians from all the parties were hurrying to climb onto the bandwagon. Well, ecological activists in this period ran the gamut from the very mainstream and moderate groups like the Audubon Society and the National Wildlife Federation, whose main interest was in bird watching and the protection of wildlife, all the way over to groups like Edward Abbey's Monkey Wrenchers. Edward Abbey was a colourful environmental writer in the 60s and 70s. And he wrote a novel called The Monkey Wrench Gang, which is about a group of eco-terrorists. That is, people who, when they realise that a big mining project is being opened up, sabotage the equipment to prevent it from working. When they find that new roads are being driven through previously wilderness areas, they tear up the engineer's stakes. That is, they commit direct acts of environmental obstruction, breaking the law in doing so, to protect the wilderness. And they also, like so many other groups in America in this era, claimed that they're acting on behalf of a threatened group. But it's no longer a threatened group of people. Now it's a threatened group of landscapes and animals as well. But much of the rhetoric and much of the techniques of the civil rights movement, which had been so widely borrowed by other groups, were borrowed by them also. Now, as I mentioned, they claimed we all breathe the same air. In fact, environmentalism was always very attractive to upper-middle-class white people, and relatively less so. The further down the socioeconomic scale you go, the less environmentalists you find. This is partly because it's usually only people who've satisfied their most important and urgent necessities of food, clothing, shelter, and regular work and income that can then turn their attention to lesser issues like a clean environment. People who haven't got a job aren't going to worry about the environment. And if it's a playoff between getting a job or protecting a grove of trees, most people will take the job, of course. So it's as it developed, environmentalism quickly became an activity and a preoccupation of prosperous people. Congressional legislation after 1960 gave greater protection to the environment than ever before. Acts were passed to improve the quality of air and water and to reduce ambient pollution levels. Clean Air Acts of 1963, 1970 and 1990 each imposed more and more tighter and tighter emissions standards to cut down on smog being released from factories and to reduce the hazard of acid rain, that is, chemicals getting into the atmosphere and falling elsewhere in the form of acidic rain which can damage forests in vulnerable areas. After 1976, it became illegal to put lead compounds into gasoline because medical research had shown a connection between high levels of lead contamination and brain damage among infants. Sometimes embarrassments led to environmental improvements. For example, the Cuyahoga River, which flows through Cleveland, caught fire in 1969 because the level of oil products floating on the surface was so great it could actually burn, and it singed many of the buildings along the waterfront and caused a national disgrace. Jokes on late night TV about how the river in Cleveland caught fire, with the result that the city then undertook an ambitious cleanup program to restore life and cleanliness to the river. The Clean Water Act of 1972 toughened up legislation from 60 and 65. So lots and lots of congressional action is saying we've got to think of the landscape not as a sink or a dump, but as itself something which is vulnerable and needs to be protected. Now, of course, as I said, it's only rich societies that can afford to do things like this. Poor ones can't. Listen to the economist Lester Thoreau describing who pays for these things. Quote, whatever technique is used to reduce pollution, it is important to understand that the consumer is going to pay. Ultimately, firms pass along the costs of all inputs to the consumers. If they must pay effluent charges, they'll raise the price of goods to cover these charges or the cost of the facilities necessary to avoid these charges. If they're forced to stop polluting by rules and regulations, they'll do the same. The costs of compliance, whatever they are, will ultimately appear in the price of the product. This is not bad, but good. If the production of paper, for example, causes pollution, we're only going to use less paper if paper is more expensive. So, in other words, reminding everybody, you pay for the cleanup. It isn't as though you can put the price on the corporation and not worry about it, but it's good that you should pay for it. It's a way of showing that you take the issue seriously. The National Environmental Policy Act, debated in Congress in 1969 and signed into law by Nixon in 1970, created the Environmental Protection Agency. And it specified that before any new construction project took place, an environmental impact statement would have to be prepared. In other words, a demonstration of how the local environment would change and what kinds of potential harm could be done to the surroundings. So, environmental damage was no longer an externality to businesses. Now it was something they had to factor in to every project right from the beginning. Legislation enhanced the status of national parks, national forests, wilderness areas, wild and scenic rivers. Bit by bit, all these things, recognised now as national assets, enjoyed the benefit, but also sometimes the hazards, of federal protection. Perhaps most striking was the Endangered Species Act of 1973, which said that in the case where an animal's population was low and where the potential of it becoming extinct arose, government must take special measures to prevent that from happening, usually by preserving the habitat in which it lived, because usually it was the removal of habitat which led to extinctions. That became a very valuable tool in the hands of environmental groups who wanted to prevent development projects from taking place. For example, the Tennessee Valley Authority wanted to build a new dam, the Tellico Dam, but the environmental impact statement showed that it was going to have an adverse impact upon a tiny little fish called the snail darter. Now, the Endangered Species Act had in view beautiful creatures like the California condor or the eagle, which is one of America's national symbols. They hadn't been interested or hadn't anticipated that a fish whose existence most people knew nothing about could become central. But it did, and it was able. And the environmentalists were able to delay the building of Tellico Dam for a long time until eventually snail darters were discovered in other parts of the Tennessee Valley environment. Similarly, deforestation in the Pacific Northwest was controversial, partly because of the age of some of the redwood trees being cut, and partly because this was the habitat of the spotted owl, which is another endangered species. Well, the energy crises of the 1970s tested the nation's dedication to environmental protection. In particular, the oil crisis of 1973 led to a congressional vote in favor of the building of a Trans-Alaska pipeline. It was the political volatility of the Middle East which made energy policy controversial in the 70s. Ever since it had come into existence in 1948, Israel had been actively or latently at war with its Arab neighbors. And there had been a series of flashpoints in 1956 during the Suez Crisis, in 1967 during the Six-Day War, and now, 1973, with the Yom Kippur War. There was a very powerful pro-Israel lobby inside the United States, and American policy had been highly favorable to Israel throughout this period since the creation of Israel. But the more America sided with Israel and its conflicts with its neighbors, the more the neighbors, which were oil-producing states, were tempted to retaliate by discrimination against the United States. So suddenly in 1973, oil exports into America were drastically cut down. The discovery of oil on the north slope of Alaska, that is in the Arctic Sea coast of Alaska, had already been, the deposits were known about since the late 60s. But the question was, since we can't get the supertankers into that area because it's usually frozen solid, we need to build a pipeline across Alaska. Environmentalists had said that its environmental impact would be very great and mainly negative, and that the pipeline ought not to be built. But after 73, after the Yom Kippur War, which showed how vulnerable America was because its economy depended partly on imported oil, Congress went ahead to vote for the building of the pipeline. In technical terms, it was a triumph. It crossed two mountain ranges, the Brooks Range and the Alaska Range, and it was able to accommodate enormous variations in temperature. In the middle of the winter, when it was empty, the temperature could go down to minus 60 or 70. Whereas when it was full of oil, creating friction in the middle of the summer, its temperature could rise up close to 100. So a massive temperature variation. But nevertheless, the metallurgy was developed to such a point that it was possible to accommodate it. It had to cross earthquake faults, and earthquake proofing was built into the pipe, and so on. In two places, it also crossed caribou migration routes, and so the pipeline had to be buried so that the caribou wouldn't be deterred from going along their usual routes. The issue there was keeping it cold enough. This is permafrost, land which a few feet below the surface is permanently frozen solid. So the pipeline had to be jacketed in a concrete surround through which pipes carrying liquid nitrogen were included to keep it cold enough and prevent it from thawing the permafrost. So a technical triumph. But nevertheless, the transfer point, Port Valdez, where the oil was taken out of the pipeline and loaded onto supertankers for transport down the west coast to Seattle and San Francisco and San Diego, this was the scene of a severe oil spill in 1989 in the 12th year of the pipeline's operation. What happened is that a ship called the Exxon Valdez sailed out of Port Valdez down Prince William Sound, slightly off course. The captain was drunk and not on the bridge. The mate at the helm was unqualified to sail in those waters. Navigation beacons which should have guided him were turned off for routine maintenance. And the result was that the ship ran aground on the Bly Reef nearby and spilled millions of gallons of crude oil into the sea. Well, Exxon, recognizing a terrible public relations disaster, because by now environmentalism was central to the national outlook, sent thousands of workers to try to clean up the mess. But the ironic long-term consequence was, by the mid-1990s, it was already clear, the areas which recovered quickest were the areas where the cleanup didn't take place. Because the impact of having all that many people coming to the beaches with cleanup gear, having to live somewhere, creating pollution of their own, using detergents against the oil, those are the places which were slowest to recover. Over the course of 10 years, gradually the dissipation of the oil pollution was nullified. So better to leave the oil from an environmental point of view, but of course from a public relations point of view, that's the last thing Exxon could have afforded to do. The other great technological challenge of the late 20th century was nuclear power. In some ways, nuclear power was clearly superior to coal-fired or hydroelectric stations. And in the 1950s, the government got behind utility companies in the attempt to build them. After all, hydroelectric meant that you had to flood valleys, usually the best farmland or scenic land. That was very unpopular. And coal-fired power stations meant that you had to have thousands of people doing coal mining, probably the most dangerous job in American life, not only because of cave-ins, but also because of long-term lung disease to the miners, several hundred of whom die prematurely every year because of the hazards of their work. Now, the claim with nuclear power was, it's absolutely clean. We don't have smoke pollution as we do from coal-fired power stations, and it's very, very potent indeed. So the federal government actively encouraged utility companies to invest in nuclear power generation through the 50s and 60s. Congress passed the Price-Anderson Act in 1957, sparing utilities from liability in the case of a nuclear catastrophe, a meltdown. But gradually, through the 1960s and early 70s, problems with nuclear power development began to emerge. First of all, thermal pollution. They take in cold water, turn it into steam, but then release it back into rivers. They're usually built on riversides, but it was still very hot, with the result that they changed the local habitat and often kill off creatures living in the rivers. Then the question arose, what do you do with the new nuclear fuel rods once they're no longer radioactive enough to be effective as fuel, but they're still too radioactive to be just disposed of in the way you normally get rid of old metals? Some of the nuclear power stations were poorly constructed, and there were some revelations that inspectors had been covering up deficient workmanship on the power stations. This led to widespread doubts about the industry in the 1970s. And all these doubts were intensified by the Three Mile Isle accident in 1979. When briefly, the controllers of a nuclear power station in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, lost control of what was happening inside the nuclear core's reaction chamber and weren't sure whether they were going to face an imminent explosion. Luckily, they were able to shut the whole place down, and nobody was killed because of what had happened at Three Mile Island. It was far, far less severe than the Chernobyl accident, which ensued in 1986. But even so, it led to a massive citizens' protest. And the rapid growth of the belief among American voters that nuclear power is just too dangerous. As long as students are demonstrating, the political parties can manage that. But once householders, mainstream middle-aged voters, are also protesting against the technology, it's got to go. So it's continued to have its advocates right up to the present. But nevertheless, since 1980, no new nuclear power stations have been built in America because it's simply too politically unpopular. And the utility companies won't take the risk of courting the opprobrium which would come to them if they were to try it. Meanwhile, it's thriving in certain other parts of the world, such as France and Japan, whose energy needs are met largely by nuclear power. And sooner or later, it's likely to revive as a viable issue. Of course, Americans, like everybody else, are very illogical in thinking about risks. The death rate from nuclear accidents has been incredibly low, whereas the death rate from coal mining has always been very, very high. Certainly, if you compare the death rates thus far, nuclear power is the safest. But we don't think about risks like that. Just as many people are afraid of flying, but will get into a car, even though you're statistically more likely to die in a car accident than you are in a plane crash. Nevertheless, the catastrophic nature of the accident when it does happen makes people think about it in different ways. By the 1980s, support for the environment was bipartisan, and it remained a central issue on the national agenda for both parties right through till the millennium. President Reagan's first Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, scorned environmental concerns. He was a lawyer from Denver who believed that development, industrial development, was far more important than conservation. And he was openly scornful of environmentalists, refusing even to meet with them, whereas President Carter, Reagan's predecessor, had been very attentive to their needs. The result was that Watt's unpopularity led to a mushroom growth in the membership of environmental organizations. And eventually, after a couple of years, both Watt himself and his EPA administrator, Ann Gorsuch, were forced to resign. The immediate cause was a racist joke which Watt made. But even so, the Republican Party, its strategists had been telling Reagan, we've got to get rid of Watt because he's costing us support among our own voters. The National Audubon Society, groups like this, have got a majority Republican membership. And we're alienating our own voters. Reagan tried to repair the damage by appointing to the Environmental Protection Agency the man whom Nixon had originally appointed back when it first came into existence, William Ruckelshaus, who was a highly regarded figure on both sides of the political divide in Washington. And after 1984, in every election, both parties and all candidates have claimed that they are the environmental candidate. For example, in 1988, when George Bush Sr. was running for the presidency, he declared that he was going to be the environmental president. And one of his campaign strategies was to attack his opponent, Michael Dukakis, claiming that Dukakis, as governor, had permitted a ruinously high level of pollution in Boston Harbor. In the election of 1992, the vice presidential candidate was Al Gore. And he just before the election came up, he published a book called Earth in the Balance, in which he said there's no issue more important in national life today than preservation and protection of the jeopardized environment. And that's a concern that he brought into the Clinton White House. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that all these candidates were necessarily sincere, but the fact that they thought it expedient to say that they were the friends of the environment, it was itself a drastic change since 1960, when the issue hadn't really even been on political radar screens at all. After about 1975, concern for and attention to the jeopardised environment has been a central issue in American political life.